I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Lily DeYoung is a young Quaker woman who is ostracized by her family and community when she becomes pregnant, left by the man who promised to marry her. She gives birth in a home for unwed mothers in Philadelphia and decides to keep her baby in defiance of tradition. Single mothers are pariahs in the 19th century, often forced to give up their children and become wet nurses for someone else's baby. Our guest, Janet Benton's novel, Lily DeYoung, is based on years of research into the treatment, really mistreatment, of single mothers and their children in Philadelphia institutions in Victorian times. And it's also based on her own experiences as a new mom, feeling the powerful bond with her daughter. This is Janet Benton's new first book, I should say, and although she has taught writing and is a writing mentor, helping others to write, this is her first book. She's the founder of the Word Studio, and she joins us to tell us how she came to write this story and the difficult choices unwed mothers have had to make in order to survive. And Janet Benton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's interesting that you have mentored other writers. Did you have to mentor yourself to write this book?
That's a good question. I actually did need to set up systems to keep myself accountable. Yeah, I had deadlines with others, and then that's what I provide for other people, too. I think it's really helpful.
You do include at the very end a lot of some of the research that you did, and it sounds like you spent years really going through archives and finding out about these institutions in Philadelphia. This could have been a work of nonfiction, and yet you chose fiction. Why that?
Well, you know, there's a sense when you look at a novel that there's must be tens of thousands of many more things that are not included. But actually, I love something that Margaret Atwood said, which is a novelist is a little bit like a crow. So, you know, you're looking for the bright things and you dive down and you grab them and you put them into your nest. So while I do know, you know, hundreds of, you know, times more than what's in the novel, I am certainly not a historian. And I chose to put it in fiction because fiction you know, puts you right into someone else's shoes. And also it's simply how it came to me. A voice started coming to me when I was reading the materials about these women.
Well, and there's some personal reasons as well. I mean, this story goes back, it seems like the roots of this story goes back to when you were a new mother with your child, but also a tragedy in your family growing up. You had a sister who died of Tay-Sachs when she was just 3 years old.
Yes. So I think I was kind of primed to write a story about the power of the bond between a mother and a child. First of all, yes, my sister died the night before I was born, the first year of my life. My family didn't know if I would live because at the time there was no genetic testing.
For Tay-Sachs.
Yeah. So they knew I would live because I lived. there's a powerful bond between my mother and I on account of that. And then when I had my own daughter, you know, it all just came back around even more powerfully for me. Just, you know, partly I think, like so many things in women's lives, you know, we're not prepared for the meaning and depth of these moments, because we don't have these, you know, at least in my world, I didn't have a tradition of, you know, passing down this is how you do this and this is how you do that. I was kind of figuring everything out myself. And I was completely just blown away by the power of this bond. And it was difficult. It was so much more difficult than I had imagined it would be. And, you know, I was solely keeping this human being alive with my milk. And I would go out and feel like, wow, if a car hit me, my baby could die. So when I started reading the history of these women and understanding that prior to the development of pasteurization, safe milk, and formula, literally an infant would die without a mother's milk. So the fact that prejudice separated mothers and their children to the meaning that their children died on account of prejudice, it just, you know, hit me in the core.
Let me raise a couple of things. One of the things that you write about motherhood, a land where pain and joy are ever mingled and where every move has a consequence, picking up on what you just said there, which is just, especially in 19th century Philadelphia, this link, this physical link between mother and child.
Yes. And I, you know, it's just as powerful today, even though we have alternatives to mother's milk. And, you know, that's one of the motivations of the book, really, is to put people in the shoes of a mother in very intimate way. I chose the diary form because it not only puts you in someone's life situation, but it puts you in their mind.
Right. And because they're in a sense writing to themselves.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So there's this ruse, right, that the reader accepts, that they're pretending that they're reading. You know, I'm having readers pretend to read someone else's diary. But the reason that I love that is because it puts you so close to the mind and the heart of the character. And I felt that this was a very emotional story, and I wanted people to feel it deeply.
Well, one sense is obviously the situation that an unwed mother at this time is in, but also just the vulnerability of children at this time. I mean, in part because they were so dependent on someone feeding them, but just knowing how difficult life was for so many children.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I mean, similarly today, you know, single mothers and their children are the most likely group to be living in poverty. But at that time, there were children roaming the streets and begging. And yeah, there were a lot fewer safeguards. You know, we have a lot of people to thank for child labor laws and compulsory education and things like that.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book. And this is where Lily is pregnant, and she goes to this home, for lack of a better word, home for unwed mothers.
Yes, and there's demanding process of discovering whether someone is worthy of admission. So, stern and long-faced, she introduced herself as Mrs. Ann Pierce, the superintendent of this establishment. She began her inquisition gently. What brings you to this shelter? How far along do you judge yourself to be? Then her questions grew more pointed, so that I thought her last name, Pierce, was apt. Have you been with child before? Was this man your first lover? How many times did you lie with him? Did others think you good? Have you ever been taken before a magistrate? Have you broken any law? How often do you drink alcohol? Do you take patent medicines regularly? I blessed my upbringing, for I could truthfully reply yes and never and no in their proper places. She stood and paced the small area behind her desk, 3 steps one way, 3 steps the other. Her tall form was clad in a gown that was demure in color and design, but made of costly wool, of the sort that only expert weavers can produce, in the old way, by hand. On such small observations I focused my thoughts, fearing the chasm that yawned behind them, into which I'd plunge if she would not take me in. At last Anne Pierce sat and proclaimed her decision. Upon considering the virtue of my previous life, and impressed by my former employment as a schoolteacher, she considered me deserving of a bed at her charity. Our furnishings are spare, she informed me, and our rations meager, but we will protect you from the damages of publicity and offer you a chance for repentance and reformation. I expressed my gratitude, saying that I asked no more. She demanded to know my lover's name then, saying it was necessary for admission, so that her solicitor could try to procure damages and support. The money, she explained, would reduce my burden and help pay the haven for my care. Spelling it out for her as she wrote, Johannes Ernst, and hearing him described as the male offender, made the situation bitterly clear. The promise of marriage, said Anne, is one of the oldest lies in the lustful man's book, often laced with exclamations over the woman's beauty. How right she was.
And that's our guest, Janet Benton, reading from her new book. It's a novel called Lily de Jong, and there she is, you know, asking essentially for admittance into this home. This is based in part on the State Hospital for Women and Infants in Philadelphia, and you include at the very beginning of your book something that was written in 1880. Every other door is closed to her who, unmarried, is about to become a mother. Deliberate, calculating, villainy, fraud, outrage, burglary, even murder, with malice aforethought, seem to excite more sympathy, more helpful pity, more efforts for the reclamation of the transgressors than are shown towards those who, if not the victims of others, are at worst but illustrations of human infirmity. So a pregnant single mother was seen as less than a burglar, less than a murderer.
Yes, yes. And, you know, as I consider these things over the years, and as people ask me, you know, why, you know, we don't have to look any further than our own society. Why are rape kits piling up in police stations? Why are abused women, you know, why do they have such a hard time getting protection from their abusers? You know, these are all ways that male privilege is sustained. And if we are sympathetic to those people, we are threatening that privilege. So, that it really does seem to me that it comes down to that.
It also seems to come down to sex.
Yes.
Like many things in life.
Right.
But the idea of a woman either enjoying sex or having sex or choosing sex. I mean, in this story, she believes that Johannes is going to marry her.
Yes.
Doesn't necessarily turn out that way, at least certainly in the beginning.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, it's only the woman who has sex who is condemned. So, and particularly so if she becomes pregnant, whether she was raped, whether she's the victim of incest, no matter. She is an emblem of shame, living shame. And, you know, women and men at that time and now can be tremendously unforgiving toward, or it's not even a matter of forgiveness. It's, you know, it's compassion and uncompassionate.
In this novel, Lily decides after having her baby and feeling this intense love and bond for this child, she is determined to try to figure out how to keep her child. She's up against some of the odds there to do that. In 19th century Philadelphia, was that considered a shocking thing to do?
Absolutely. I should say that there are many layers of society, many communities within any culture. So there are some communities where it might not have been as shocking. I placed her because I wanted it to be shocking, and I also wanted her to have this religious upbringing that had given her the courage to believe that she had the capacity to know what was right, even if it went against society. So, you know, would Quakers of the time have said, oh, great, you know, use your Quaker beliefs to keep your baby as an unwed mother? Would they have said, oh, wonderful, no, right? And in that sense, I kind of feel like she's a character on the brink of modernity, right? She's taking this idea of personal rights, you know, to another step.
Almost up in a break here. Lily DeYoung, it's such an interesting name. Why did you come up with that name?
Lily is a name I've always loved. I had a friend named Lily as a child. And DeYoung, it's a Dutch name. The ancestry of the people who founded Germantown, many of them were originally Dutch Quakers, some of them by way of Germany. So I wanted that name, but I did not want a name that was connected to any existing family that I knew of. So DeYoung means the young. And I thought, well, who but a very young person would believe that the world could be kind to her even if, you know, she bore this stain?
Makes a lot of sense. That's Janet Benton, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about her new novel. In fact, it's her first book, and it is called Lily DeYoung. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with Janet Benton about her new novel called Lily DeYoung. It's based on many years of research that she did into the lives of single mothers and their children in 19th century Philadelphia. Lily fights to keep her child, has to make some tough choices to survive. And I'm talking with Janet Benton about some of the thinking that went into this novel and some of the research that she did as well. Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book, and this is at the children's asylum. So without giving too much of the story away, Lily's determined to keep her child, but has to work hard to make that happen.
Yes, yes. So this is a nursery at the what was the old Blockley almshouse hospital complex, the public hospital and almshouse in Philadelphia, which used to be in West Philadelphia. At the children's asylum, I stepped into the glare of the white-hot sun. Along the front of the building, I tried the doors. All were locked. But at the back, a high row of windows ran for 30 feet or so, and a modest tree protruded from the dirt. It offered a chance I couldn't decline. I hiked up my gown, took hold of the dun trunk, and hauled myself to its lowest branch, then to the one above. If I could erase what I saw next from my mind, I would do so rather than suffer my hand to write it down. But the hollow cheeks and feeble cries of those 100 friendless persons will never leave me. It might be less cruel of the nurses to give the infants arsenic when they're taken in, so as to let them be done sooner with their lot. Except that Charlotte is likely among them, and a few others, as Anne noted, might somehow live. I leaned to the windows and saw a single enormous hall with cribs in rows, holding perhaps 100 babies, with only the littlest ones crying or moving. The rest lay silent and immobile, while their stick-like limbs and bony faces spoke volumes. Malnourished or dehydrated or diseased or all three, they looked as though they could exhale their souls with their very next breaths. Their swathing cloths were stained with spit-up, the only sign of their having been fed. And who was caring for these frail beings? Two debilitated women were slouched in rocking chairs at each of the hall's four corners, and two more were seated halfway down each of the four walls. That came to 16, one per six or so children. A pap boat sat beside each chair, used for feeding the babies, no doubt, along with a pitcher of grayish milk and a glass, probably for the women's nutriment. The women looked into the air ahead, each with a failing baby at her breast, perhaps thinking of the men who had violated them, run off, or died, or of their own misdeeds, or of the families who were unable to help.
That's just such a searing description. I feel like I see that. I wonder whether, from your research, were there ever photographs of what it was like in old Blocky in West Philadelphia?
No, and this is an invention of my mind. There was a nursery. There was a phenomenally high death rate. They wore brown. There are as many details as I could get into here. They used pap boats. They gave the women milk, et cetera. But as far as there being a place where one could actually look in the window, that I made up. There may well have been, but I don't know.
And these were the women, the sort of fallen women of the time. They were wet nurses. And for a time, Lily is a wet nurse as well.
Yes. Often in an almshouse, if a woman had a baby, she would be called upon to nurse other babies because, as I said, there was no other way that the babies would stay alive. But clearly six infants per woman is not going to turn out too well. Yeah.
There's a lot of nursing in this book.
I'll
just put it that way.
Yes.
I mean, it's true when you have a young child, you are going to do a lot of nursing.
Yes.
But that seems so central to your story.
Yes. And interestingly, it's the one thing that has gotten me, one very negative review on Goodreads, not a tremendously, important place. But whatever. Yeah. So a couple of people are horrified by the nursing. And I think that's interesting. That's okay with me.
In 2017.
Yeah. Yeah. My husband made a joke, that breastfeeding is like the last taboo, right? You can all sorts of things are fine on screen or in public, but, not breastfeeding. So, but to me, that's a fundamental part of being a mother if you choose to do that. And it's incredibly powerful. It makes you have an extraordinary bond with your infant. But simply on a practical level, if I had written in every time that she breastfed, there would be, between 10 and, if she's taking care of two infants, perhaps 20 per day. So there's actually hardly any nursing compared to what was really happening.
Right. It just feels that way.
Yes.
And certainly for young mothers, it certainly feels that way as well. This is written in the form of a diary. I read you kept a diary or diaries, something like 200 of them?
Yeah. I've been keeping a diary since I was maybe nine. And my mother kept a diary. That's, I think, probably where I got the idea. But I think, diaries are powerful. We matter in our diaries. And I think that it's a place where we can hone our own voice. Things we write in our diaries are not things we're ready to share with the world yet, but maybe they prepare us to come out into the world.
You still have your 200 diaries?
I do. I have several trunks.
Do you really?
Yeah. I'm a little afraid. No, I do not. I have not gone back. And I, in fact, in deciding to write this book, I kind of barely have written in a diary since I started this book. This had to become my substitute simply because finding the time to do both wasn't possible.
You don't want to hear or read what the 9-year-old Jenna Benton had to say about herself?
I do. I will. You know, it feels overwhelming. But yeah, I mean, we all have that fictional time in the future where we get to read our diaries and read all the novels we haven't read and organize all the photographs and, you know.
Has anyone else ever read your diaries?
My mother has read a couple of things over the years. That's all I know of. But, you know, who knows? Some boyfriend may have done it, or husband. Yeah, my husband could have. I don't think so. My husband's incredibly ethical.
Oh, he's right. So hopefully he isn't rooting through your diaries
while we're talking on the air. Yeah, yeah.
Do you see Lily DeYoung as a heroine? A Victorian heroine?
Absolutely. And I modeled her after some books that I adored when I was younger. You know, I shouldn't say modeled her after, but I mean her to be in the company of people, you know, who still live in the imagination, whether it's Hester Prynne and The Scarlet Letter or Jane Eyre or, you know, Tess of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy. You know, these are well, with the exception of Jane Eyre, Unwed Mothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think getting to be close to a woman who persists is a nice thing.
Was it hard to write this? I mean, this is your first novel. As I said in my introduction, you've helped other people write their books. But, you know, writing a novel is not necessarily an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and it came together kind of like a patchwork quilt at times. There were sections that I could really easily see and write, and then there were parts that it took me many, many years to be able to, like the scene of the mother dying took me a very long time.
This is Lily's mother.
Yes. And figuring out toward the end sort of, you know, what were the trials she was going to go through, you know, just how bad were things going to get. I'm happy to report they don't get as bad as they could have. And that was a conscious choice. I think as a society, we are addicted to women's victimization. And while I wanted to show that her life was difficult, I did not want her to be a victim.
You also write, there are several sex scenes that you write about, including the one where she has sex with the man who says he wants to marry her. And there's also the father or the man of the house where she goes as a wet nurse, you know, trying to seduce her.
Yes. So as far as the first one goes, you know, it was also important to me that she not be someone who accepted the shame that was put upon her. I wanted to show that, you know, having sex with someone you love is a beautiful thing. And it was a beautiful thing for her. And
I think surprisingly beautiful thing for her. I mean, you know, having grown up at that time.
Yeah. And it, it came as a shock to her. She was not prepared for the power of it. And she ultimately doesn't regret it. So as far as the other moments, yeah, certainly there she's vulnerable to exploitation.
Right. And I guess women in similar situation at that time, in order to survive for themselves or survive for their child, had to sometimes make a really difficult choice or choices that they would regret under different circumstances.
Absolutely, yes. Many women were and are forced into prostitution in order to support their children.
There's a scene where she's kind of begging on the streets of Philadelphia with her child. She has a sign and you see sort of urchins running around and all of that. Was that based on some research that you did in Philly at the time?
Again, I pulled a lot of pieces together and then created something. But yes, I read a lot about the street life and vagrancy laws. And, you know, and then there's a beautiful book set in New York called How the Other Half Lives by Jacob Riis, he was a photographer and a journalist. And so, you know, kind of pieced a lot of those things together, read a lot about foundlings and, yeah, did an enormous amount of research into charitable giving at the time and sort of attitudes toward the poor.
What kept you going? I mean, you spent years and years of research on this.
That's a good question. You know, I, for some reason, didn't want to die without having at least one meaningful contribution to the world of books. And that's what drove me.
Oh, really? I mean, feeling that sense of your own mortality?
Yes. Not that I'm in any imminent risk that I know of, but I just, you know, I've been a reader and a writer my whole life. And if I had not at least finished one book, that would not have been the life I wanted to live.
You have helped other people write their books.
Yes.
Were there things that surprised you about what it takes to actually write a book?
You know, I haven't worked with anybody who's worked as hard as I have.
Oh, is that right?
That's a terrible thing to say. Okay. Memoirists. That is a slog. I think that's even harder than writing fiction. But there aren't a lot of fiction writers willing to put you know, 8,000 hours into a book, which is what I put into this one. And I'm kind of fanatical, so I wouldn't expect very many people to damage their spines and bank accounts to that degree.
But did you count each and every hour so you can say,
no,
I worked 8,000
No, but I'm estimating, yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting how you sort of mixed fact and fiction, but back in 1873, there was a thing called the Comstock Laws,
yes,
which made it illegal to send information about birth control, about protection from sexually transmitted diseases, about abortion. Of course, abortion was illegal then. It was done, but it was illegal then. Anything that seems – I wrote that down because I was thinking about efforts to try to prevent women from getting birth control today.
Yes. Well, it is very interesting that there was actually a law and a special position at the U.S. Postal Service to suppress the communication of even romantic feelings by letter, in private letters.
So someone was reading the mail.
Yes. But also, you know, the selling of birth control methods or information about birth control, information about abortifacients, pornography, you know, what was deemed smut. Yeah, that was, I mean, it's kind of astounding. It's a moment in our history that perhaps we know less about than Prohibition, but equally significant.
Mm-hmm. And how long were the Comstock Laws in effect?
If I remember correctly, I believe it was like 1912 when, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could actually send this information through the mail.
But, so. I, you know, don't quote me. I'd have to go back and look.
Right. It isn't, I mean, obviously abortion was illegal then, but as you describe a couple of characters, I mean, they certainly made attempts to try to abort their fetus,
yes,
their child.
Yes, and the word abortion now we think of as meaning an operation. What it meant, what it was used to mean then was, you know, any method of you know, damaging your fetus or your pregnancy to the point that it would end. Yes, so women would throw themselves down the stairs. They would take poisons. They would, of course, you know, put things inside themselves at great risk of bleeding to death.
In order to prevent this child that, especially if you weren't married, was going to be a kind of albatross,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, well, your life could be ruined. Mm-hmm. If someone, for instance, let's just say, you know, someone's cousin rapes her and she's pregnant, her life is ruined. So, you know, naturally, people would try to find ways of getting out of that situation.
You have a daughter?
Yes.
I mean, and how much of your writing is with her in mind?
Well, certainly, you know, my love for Charlotte, the infant in this book, is very informed by my love for my beautiful daughter. She's my treasure. And also informed by my mother's love for me. You know, I'm lucky that there's a three-generation, you know, deep love bond here. So, yeah.
What was your mother's love for you? What did that feel like?
Well, I think, you know, literally because I lived after my sister died, you know, my mother said I renewed her hope. You know?
Wow.
That's the
after
role
the
that
tragic
I have
loss of,
yes,
of her first daughter.
Yes. And you know, she says I was born with a compassionate heart, and I do remember her pain.
Your mother's pain?
Yes.
As a little girl, you
remember
that?
Yes, yeah. I actually learned very little about my sister until I started interviewing my parents about it when I was in my late 30s. We very rarely, there was almost nothing ever said, and there were very few photographs. My mother couldn't talk about it and still cannot talk about it without crying. So I think really informed the book too, in the sense that, you know, we have this idea that, oh, okay, so you go away, you give up a baby for adoption, and then you go back to your life. No. You know, I read a lot about what women then and now feel. And no, you do not say goodbye to a child ever. There is no way of severing that bond.
Right. It's so, I mean, to be a little girl and to be so sort of aware of one's parents' pain and loss, and
yes,
of course, knowing you were born the day after your sister.
Yes,
died.
My mother went into labor. They got in the car. The phone rang. My dad went to answer it, and it was the hospital saying my sister had died. Yeah. So on the day I was born, my father was making funeral arrangements for my sister. Yeah. I actually have a novel in process that's kind of a fictional version of some of this, but I haven't quite figured out a way to tell it fully yet. That's not just like, you know, endlessly miserable.
Have you talked to your dad about it? As you said,
your
mother, it's so difficult for her.
Yes, I have talked to my dad about it too. Yeah.
Is it a different kind of pain, you think?
He was a doctor. And so one of the things he focused on was, you know, is there a treatment? Is there anything we can do? You know, how can we get these enzymes, you know, how can we get this fat from out of her brain, from building up in her brain?
Which is what happens with Tay-Sachs.
Yes. And then he was the one who delivered my sister, to the hospital, where she was kept for the last year and a half of her life when it came to the point that they couldn't take care of her at home anymore. Nowadays, they would have made you take care of the child at home. At that time, they didn't have those, home situations.
Well, did you have any trepidation about having a child yourself, having a baby?
No. No, I did not. You know, I am a Tay-Sachs carrier, and my daughter may be too. But I married a goy.
That's a kind of insurance policy.
Not on purpose. No, it just worked out that way. If I hadn't, there is genetic testing now. You know, and I was tested. He was tested. Yeah.
Is there another? Well, you mentioned the fact that there's probably another novel at work.
Yes, I actually have three in process. A lot of, you know, interesting family history, and then some things I'm interested in today. I don't know if it's going to be a historical. I don't know which one's going to grab me and not let go. Now that I know what an extraordinary commitment it is, I think I'm a little bit afraid to, let it grab me. I keep, like, dropping the hand of the one that tries to hold on.
Oh, so you've got three trying to hold your hand through this process.
Yes.
Well, Janet Benton, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your novel as well.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Janet Benton's novel, her very first novel, Lily DeYoung, that's the title. And I should add that she's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Well, we're up on a break, and very shortly, right after that break, we'll be talking with Penn State Professor of Meteorology, David Titley. We'll be talking about the fact that NOAA is predicting a busy hurricane season this year, especially if you live on the Atlantic coast. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the federal agency responsible for weather forecasting, has predicted an above-average hurricane season in the Atlantic in 2017. President Trump has proposed budget cuts to both NOAA and FEMA, which is responsible for disaster relief often called on after a big storm. Both agencies are also without a top administrator. We asked David Titley to join us to talk about hurricane predictions and our preparedness for storms and emergencies. He's a professor of meteorology at Penn State University, the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. He's a retired Rear Admiral. In fact, he led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change, and he's a former NOAA Chief Operating Officer. David Titley, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty. Appreciate it.
So what is NOAA looking at predicting above average season for hurricanes? What are their criteria?
So I guess a couple things on these extended range forecasts for hurricanes. And the first is for everybody to understand that these crystal balls are pretty cloudy in general. So really, I would not focus on exact numbers of, you know, whether it's 13 or 15 or 17 or whatever the number of storms are, but they can give some indication of, is it going to be a particularly active season or a particularly quiet season? And what NOAA and really quite a few other places, both private companies as well as universities, put out these forecasts, they're looking primarily at what are the sea surface temperature signals actually all the way in the Pacific. And probably people are thinking, wait a second, Titley, did you not hear the question? We're supposed to be talking about Atlantic hurricanes.
Exactly.
Who cares about the Pacific? Turns out the weather cares. The weather cares a lot. And I'll bet many of your listeners have heard of something called El Nino and La Nina. And usually we think about this in the wintertime. It changes, how much rain comes into California and, you know, really whether or not it's going to be a mild winter or a cold winter for here in the Northeast. Turns out, though, the El Nino sea surface temperatures all the way in the Pacific, like south of Hawaii, around the equator, have a big impact on how many hurricanes we can get in the Atlantic. And it's not that the water temperatures of the Pacific like bleed over through the Panama Canal. That's not happening into the Atlantic. But what does happen is the temperatures, the water temperatures in the Pacific, believe it or not, change how the winds blow in the upper atmosphere. Wow. Over the Atlantic. So that's the connection. That's why people, you know, why you hear people talk about El Nino. And, you know, and if you look at it, it's like, hey, wait a second, Pacific, Atlantic, what's the thing? So for all of those reasons, it turns out that when you have El Nino conditions, in general, you expect fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic. And when you have the reverse, it's called La Nina, you expect more. So this year, actually, most of the forecast for El Nino and La Nina are kind of saying it's about a 50% chance or 45% chance that we're going to be about normal. Maybe there's actually a little bit of chance that we would have an El Nino and not very much chance for a big La Nina. So if you think about that, then that would say maybe the forecast would be normal or even a little bit less than normal. But there's other things that go into this, too. So NOAA and really everybody else looks at what do they think the winds are going to be over the Atlantic. Hurricanes seem to come in sort of these multi-decadal, like 20 or 30-year kind of cycles. You'll go through a cycle in which it's pretty active, like in the 60s and 70s. And then in the late 70s and 80s until about 1995 or so, we had really very few hurricanes. And then it got really busy again. And, of course, I'm sure a lot of people still remember, like, almost now over 10 years ago, the seasons of 2004, 2005 were just incredible. So we're kind of probably towards the end of that active season. So you say, okay, it's kind of still in the active phase. The temperatures are going to be probably the El Nino signal, most likely average. The water temperatures themselves, in part due to man-made climate change, are warmer and warmer. And while warm sea surface temperature is necessary for hurricanes, it's not the only thing you need, but having it, you know, can sort of kick these things off. So you sort of blend all these things together, kind of stir, add a pinch of salt, and you come up with your forecast.
Well, that's so interesting because it once you get into the details of this, some of these headlines then are a little misleading because I hear the gray cloudiness in your crystal ball, which is, yeah, we could have some more storms than maybe we've had in the past, but you know, maybe not what superstorm Sandy. Can we predict something?
Well, this is really. I think if there's anything, I mean, so I've gone through this, and probably like you know, five of your listeners are really geeking out on the science, and the rest are like wondering what is this guy talking about. But here's something probably everybody should know. You know, and it's almost a cliche, but it is one of these ones that is true, is it only takes one storm to ruin your whole day.
Right.
So the classic example for this is Hurricane Andrew, and I'm sure, you know, a number of your viewers remember in the early 1990s, it was, I think it was 92, if I remember right, very quiet season. So Andrew, if I remember, it was August, you know, and it's the A storm. So we waited until August to have anything. But that one storm became a Category 5, you know, and went into just south of Miami around Homestead, Florida. You know, they never, you know, it was just absolutely devastating. Billions and billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And everybody said, well, it's a quiet season. And it's like, and it was a quiet season. But that one storm ruined your whole day.
Well,
so I, you know, ask, plead, implore everybody who lives on the Gulf Coast or on the East Coast or even inland, like places like Vermont. You know, maybe some of your listeners go up to Vermont or New England for vacation or in the summer or whatever. They can get a whole lot of rains out of these storms. It just takes one. So really, we all need to be ready for hurricane season, which, you know, has started on the 1st of June and will go until the 30th of November. because it just takes one to ruin your whole day.
You mentioned Andrew, and I think people living here in the Philadelphia area, certainly along the New Jersey shore, it's Sandy. I mean, that's a storm that we think of, and we're still in many ways still dealing with all the fallout from Sandy, the beaches that got dragged away, and even some of the infrastructure problems in New York City are Sandy related. Are we prepared for that next big superstorm?
And that's the $64 question, right? Because these big storms, whether you call it a superstorm or like the Long Island Express back from the 50s, we up here in the Mid-Atlantic region, we are vulnerable to hurricanes and to big hurricanes. They're not always just dying out, or it's not just a rainfall event for Vermont or New Hampshire or upstate New York or Pennsylvania. We can, on the coast, get these big hurricanes, and it's just as important that all of our emergency management is ready for it, that our infrastructure is hardened, just like you would think about it if we lived in Florida or Mississippi or mm-hmm. South Carolina. Because when you get hit, and especially if you're not ready for it, the damages can last for years and years. I had a house that was 10 miles away from the landfall of Katrina.
Really?
And my home, it was in a place called Waveland, Mississippi, right on the coast, right near the Louisiana border, is still struggling.
And it's still struggling 10 years later. Wow.
12 years. Yeah, it'll be 12 years this August, and it is still a place that looks completely different than it did on the 28th of August, 2005, the day before the hurricane made landfall. So these are life-changing events, and we can't stop the hurricane, of course, but we can build and prepare to minimize the not only the economic disruption, but really the social disruption.
Well, let me ask you, because you're a retired Rear Admiral, you actually led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change, and I have certainly read that the military, probably the Navy, has been preparing for climate change, seeing the effects of, I guess, sea level rise and other issues as well. Is the military doing a better job than other institutions?
I would say the military is certainly aware of this, and like really all of us in our daily lives, you try to account for a lot of different risks that are coming up. Some of them you see today. Others look like the worst of the effects maybe sometime in the future. So, whether it's us with our household budget and we're preparing for, an event we think might happen 10 or 20 years from now, or whether you're a government agency thinking about, how do you spend your money? I would say the Navy is certainly cognizant of these risks. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, I could stand back and say, well, you should be doing A, B, C, D more. That's really easy to say when you're retired. I think they are trying to balance all of these risks, and they're certainly aware of them. I mean, the Navy has to deal with tremendous changes in the Arctic, the sea level rise. It's while it's slow, it's inexorable, and every storm surge comes in a little bit higher than the previous one. So that is an issue. And then, of course, the bigger geopolitical threats. I sometimes say that climate change makes bad places worse, and it's a long series of events, but climate change was one of the links in a long chain that gave us the catastrophe that is Syria. So it has many impacts on the military, from changing the environment, changing our bases, and really changing the geopolitical landscape.
So we're seeing climate wars or conflicts already?
I would be very cautious to say that we are seeing climate wars. It's much more complex than sort of if you have a drought, then you have a climate catastrophe. So, for example, in Syria, in addition to having a catastrophic drought about 10 years ago that most climate scientists are pretty convinced was certainly made worse by climate change, you had very big non-climate events happening in Syria as well, such as the Iraq War, which actually put a million Iraqi refugees into Syria. You have the fact that President Assad, if we just speak very frankly, does not take good care of his people and never has. So there's very poor governance in the in the nation itself. He did not take care of his citizens who had needs there. So you have to really put all of these things together. President Assad, back in the 70s, said, I'm going to go and be self-sufficient in things like wheat and barley. You would have hoped that his advisors back then would have said, you know, hey, boss, we live in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's kind of a dry place. Maybe this isn't the smartest thing you've ever done. But nobody said that. And they actually did achieve self-sufficiency, but they did it at a cost of drawing down their rivers, drawing down their aquifers, so they had no reserves. They had nothing. It's like, you know, spending all your checking account down to zero, maxing out your credit cards, and then you have a big, you know, disaster at home, and now you have nothing. So there were a lot of factors that went into this. You know, we had, of course, a huge drought in California, but we did not have Syria as a result. And because we, you know, we're much more prepared, we take care of our citizens, we have reserves, we have buffers. So I don't want to say that climate by itself causes these, but in the Syria case, it was certainly one of the links in this catastrophic chain.
The White House does want to cut the budget for NOAA, the budget for FEMA as well, and neither of those organizations have an administrator yet. Is that going to hurt our ability to forecast the weather and prepare for big storms?
So having been the chief operating officer of NOAA, I can tell you that the day-to-day forecasts from the National Weather Service, including the hurricane forecast, will be fine, irrespective of whether or not President Trump nominates a NOAA administrator. Where it hurts NOAA is their long-term strategic direction. They have thousands of very highly trained, very dedicated professionals today in the Weather Service, in NOAA as a whole, that will do their best, their very best, to put out forecasts to protect life and property. But what NOAA doesn't have is sort of that leadership to figure out, hey, when we look down the road 5, 15, 20 years, what do we need NOAA to be? And then be able to work with the Congress for both policy and the money, the resources, to make that happen. So that's what's left. It's sort of like, you know, the car will keep driving itself and will do a very good job, but somebody at some point needs to tell that car where to go. But as far as being able to forecast hurricanes, NOAA will, you know, without an administrator, even if we don't get one until, I don't know when we'll get one, but I would, that is, of all the things we can worry about, and we have a ton to worry about in this country right now, that's not one that we need to worry about.
Almost out of time here. So what are you worrying about, David Tilley?
Well,
in
I do
45
like the Secretary
seconds.
Mattis. Yes, I like the Secretary Mattis quote that it's better to have other people worrying about what you're doing rather than the other way around. I wish I was clever enough to come up with that. What I worry about is really that America can lead on the world stage still, both on things like we've been talking about with our weather and climate forecasting technical capabilities, as well as really making sure that we maintain our alliances with our longstanding allies and friends. That's what I worry about.
Well, David Tilley, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, telling us what you worry about and what we should worry about as well.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of meteorology at Penn State University, also the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. And as I mentioned, he's a retired Rear Admiral, led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change, former NOAA Chief Operating Officer. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.